Welcome to 1 in 7 on CHSR 97.9 on your FM dial. 1 in 7 is a twice-monthly show which will deal with issues relating to poverty. It is our hope to foster awareness and a better understanding of the problems associated with the fact that 1 in 7 Canadians live in poverty. This week, we are going to learn about a local organization, the Fredericton Community Action Group on Homelessness, and the Housing First approach to ending homelessness. We have with us in studio Faith McFarland, the Executive Director of the Fredericton Community Action Group on Homelessness, often referred to as CAG. And prior to working with CAG, Ms. McFarland was Program Development Communications Officer at the John Howard Society and was the Employment Coordinator with the YMCA Department of International and Community Development. Thank you for being with us today, Ms. McFarland.
Well, thanks for inviting me in, Kay.
Let's start with some basics. On a personal level, what inspired you to work on issues relating to poverty to affect change in your community?
On a personal level, I was raised by adults who in the 1980s were really involved with the anti-poverty movement. Like in the mid-1980s, we saw like a real gap open up around social services and programming, and the safety net, I think, that we had grown accustomed to started to kind of come unhinged. There was a big de-investment in housing and other programs we had grown to rely on. So back in the middle of the 1980s, we saw a lot of responses in terms of the development of emergency services, like soup kitchens and food banks and the shelters here in our community in Fredericton, all came about within a two-year span of each other. And so as a child growing up in that time, those services were talked about as stopgap measures or an emergency response that was needed. And it was interesting as a kid back, 30-some years ago, those things were just temporary. So really what brought me to that in adulthood is seeing a lot of the same people stuck in the same circumstances they were, if they're still with us, this many years later. So really a drive not just to be able to manage things from a stopgap perspective or an emergency perspective, but what kind of levers could we change in society in the long run to make a significant change?
Let's look at some of the descriptive terms applied to the word homelessness. I've heard episodic homelessness and other terms. What do all these terms mean?
I think when you want to be able to address anything, you have to know what it is you're looking at. And we have varying definitions of what it means to be homeless. And in Canada, through a lot of the work of the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness at York University and other people working in the field, just coming up with a commonly accepted definition. And so there's many different forms of homelessness. We know folks who are living in their cars, other folks who couch surf, some people who sleep outside, other people who are squatting in housing unsuitable for human habitation. And when it comes to definitions around like episodic or chronic, those are really specific and has to do with the length of time that somebody's homeless or the amount of time somebody's homeless. So for example, if somebody is episodically homeless, it means that they would have had three or more episodes in a year. And if somebody's chronic, it means they've been homeless, they're currently homeless, and they've been homeless for 6 months or more over the past year. And the reason those terms are so important is as we look at how people move through housing insecurity and how it impacts us. So when we talk about chronic and episodic, that's a real small subpopulation of folks who end up on the streets, but they're the people who are the most vulnerable when it comes to homelessness because they've been trapped in a long-term cycle or they're more prone to end up back out there. So they tend to have, if we've ended up outside for a long time or in provisional housing or emergency housing or shelters, tend to, a lot of the survival strategies that come along with that tend to strengthen a lot of the risk factors associated when it comes to chronic health issues and all that stuff. Those increase as well. So those definitions are really important because it actually helps us figure out how do we respond to that population and best support them.
Is there some sort of pattern? Like, are there more homeless men or homeless women? Is it about 50-50?
It's a good question. Like, it's disproportionate when we think in our mind. I think a lot of times when we think about what the face of homelessness looks like, we think of men quite often, and demographically, when you do studies and you try to gather snapshots, here in our city, we did something that's called a point in time count, and that's like a snapshot over a 24-hour period and gives you a sense not just about how many people are homeless on that day or during that time. It has a sense, too, of genders and age and that spread, and we saw that disproportionately the people who participated in the survey or the study were males, and so we're looking more at like a 60-40 split. However, one of the realities of homelessness is it's really hard to count it because people who are homeless are hidden for a whole variety of reasons. And more often than not, women and children, when we become homeless, are on someone's couch or are more vulnerable, so we're less recognized, less counted. So just because the numbers often lean towards a higher proportion of homeless people are counted as male, there's still a lot of significantly vulnerable women and children who also end up on the streets who just aren't enumerated.
I'd like to touch on what it is that you see as the role of the Community Action Group on Homelessness.
I think the role is we have a lot of nonprofits, government agencies, community leaders who all share a concern around homelessness and work in different areas and have our own strengths. A Community Action Group on Homelessness is something that's called a Community Advisory Board, and we have 61 of them in Canada. And that's under something that's called a Homelessness Partnering Strategy. It's a federal structure. And it's recognizing that at a community level, it's where we're best equipped to be able to respond to something like homelessness. There's stuff that impacts us globally across the country or provincially. But really the nuts and bolts is at a community level, we're best equipped to be able to respond to homelessness because we know what kind of assets and resources we have. And then we also know what kind of gaps we have. So a community action group on homelessness, being one of these community advisory boards, works as a way of bringing community together to keep a conversation going about how do we improve our response to homelessness. So having the chance to coordinate gives us an opportunity to be able to collect data. It gives us an opportunity to host community-level dialogue and conversation. And it gives us the opportunity to bring in the voices of people with lived experience that are often overlooked and absent. So the role of the action group is to be able to bring those voices to the table and then to be able to move on in a coordinated response to some of the recommendations and ideas and wishes that come forward.
What are CAG's specific objectives, say, for the next 3 or 4 years?
Sure. The CAG's specific objective in terms of our shared mandate is like the best way to describe it. It's a joint community initiative of over 30 different nonprofits and government departments and community leaders who work together with the main objective of ending chronic and episodic homelessness in Fredericton. So over the next 36 months, we're about 2 years into our strategic plan to end chronic episodic homelessness. So that's really what we're focusing on. And specifically, what that means for us is some really neat steps that haven't really existed in our community before. One of that is having these nonprofits that work in the homeless system for us to identify and use a common intake and assessment system. I think for a lot of folks that sounds boring or uninteresting, but in the past, like a lot of the services we have is we have folks who are really vulnerable going door to door to door to door using a lot of different services when you're in a state of crisis and there's very little dialogue between us. When people are having to go door to door to door for services, they're having to retell their story, which is often traumatic. So one of the first steps in terms of our work over the next few years is developing a common language we use, building our own shared data management system using something called the Homeless Individual and Family Information System. And that's an online data information source where we're able to have people who are in our outreach teams and people who do the intake and assessment be able to communicate more freely between different organizations so we can try to find the right level of support more quickly for that person. And the other emphasis as a result is as we're going through and collecting this information, figuring out like who is chronic and who is episodic, figuring out the right level of support. So part of the work over the next few years is making sure when we know who these individuals are, that those supports are there. So that's building teams, clinical teams that have been research and evidence-based to be able to support somebody who's got a lot of stuff going on in their life. So people often with the most complex needs in our society are usually the least likely to receive services. So in the next 3 years, the work we're doing is building housing first response. So that means having access in community to something called intensive case management. That's a really low client-to-worker ratio. It's something that really is client-driven as opposed to program-driven or organization-driven. and making sure that it's easy for people with the most complex needs to get that service, being able to access peer support models, which are really critical when we work with people who have experienced long-term homelessness, because these are very resilient, very strong people who have gone through a lot. And I think the transitions they need in terms of getting access back into the system and getting support, a lot of time that has to come from somebody with a similar lived experience. And then also in conjunction to that, it means the housing that's required to stably house the population as well. So the work in front of us is pretty specific. It's the creation of housing first units. We're hoping in our community, our infrastructure, we need about 40 units that are purpose-built for people who've experienced long-term homelessness. We need to build an intensive case management team that has the capacity to work with approximately 60 to 80 people at any one time. And we need peer supports where peers are actually paid for the specialization they have and the gifts that they bring to this table. And then also there are systems around that that we're working to build in terms of changes in policy that look at the inclusion of something that's called rapid rehousing. In our community in New Brunswick, our housing is overseen provincially through the Department of Social Development. And when it comes to housing supports, we often have like one solution that's most commonly used is a rent subsidy program, and that's rent geared income. And that fluctuates over your lifetime. And through that system right now, we have 1,500 people in our community on a wait list for that program. Some of the best practices that are happening in North America is using a model that's called rapid rehousing. In some situations, people don't necessarily need a lifelong subsidy or access to it. Instead, it may mean that they need time-limited supports to prevent homelessness. So it's a response that's used for lower acuity or transitional homelessness as opposed to episodic and chronic, which would often look at a response like housing first. So in the work over the next 3 years is to really promote and to insist, you know, in our community and across our province and even in Canada, that we have models of rapid rehousing that assist people who are lower acuity as well.
You did mention the Housing First model. What exactly does that mean?
Housing First is a radically different approach to responding to homelessness. It was started in the States by a psychiatrist, a street psychiatrist named Dr. Sam Tabaris, who worked in New York City, who was charged with working with people who were living on our streets who had really, really, really complex needs, people who may be living with psychosis or long-term debilitating depression. And what he's finding is when somebody's living outside and they're in a state of crisis, there was no way for him to gain any traction, for him to get any recovery or any support, because the person was continually in a state of crisis. You can't do any future planning. And as a doctor, something that he realized is that first I'm going to stabilize somebody, and the best way to stabilize them is through access to housing. It's non-institutional support, so instead of putting somebody into an institutional setting, your first step is you're providing the person with access to housing. And then the second step is allowing them to be able to access services, support services that are really driven by them. And something that I find interesting about Housing First is it's so self-evident, is that like if somebody is in a state of survival and living hand-to-mouth or having a fight-flight-freeze response, just like any of us would have when we're in crisis, it flips it on its head, and it's not saying, first, I want you to be able to calm down, then I'm going to help you. Like so many of the support services we have in society is saying, well, first, get your act together. You're going to recover, you're going to get sober, you're going to get treatment, or you're going to become more polite, so on and so forth. If you do these things, then we're going to work with you. And we're asking somebody who's living with more stress than many of us could ever imagine. I've had the misfortune and the privilege of working with and knowing people in our community who do live in lean-tos, who live behind, a man who was living under a wheelchair ramp. I know people who live in our forests. And these people are, imagine the fortitude it would take, like day in and day out, to pull that off. And then we're asking a person on top of doing that, right, when you don't have access to a bathroom, you don't have access to warmth, you don't necessarily are able to protect your medications or any of your goods, we're asking them to follow some very complex steps when you look at accessing a health system or a mental health system or a recovery system. And for most of us, that's a challenge. If we were unwell in our own home, it's hard to pull that off, let alone when you're living in a state of chaos. A Housing First system recognizes that, and it recognizes that the people who are often impacted by homelessness aren't necessarily impacted by a deficit. These are people who have great worth, and they have insights, and they have importance, and they also have a right to housing. And that the logical first step for any person, in terms of looking at moving ahead with a chronic health issue or a mental health issue or an addiction issue, is really to get your kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Is that first level is first you're going to get housed, you're going to get comfortable. And the housing first model works on that premise, is we're going to start there. And it's neat to see it actually does work. A lot of times when folks have been trapped in a cycle of homelessness, it's really easy. Once we've been on the streets, it's easy to end up on the streets again. Like the survival strategies that we have when we live out on the streets are very different than the survival strategies I would need as a tenant, right? And so I may have spent months or years cultivating those survival strategies and I get housed. And what we're seeing as a cycle is that if somebody's been on the streets, it's an indicator you're going to end up on the streets again. So typically if somebody's been long-term homeless, there's about a 30% chance after being housed and maintain housing. In a normal model, treatment as usual, which means just like, you know, market value rent or even rent geared income without the right kind of supports. If someone's been chronic or episodic in the past, there's only a 30% chance they'll maintain housing. However, by accessing Housing First model, there's an 80% chance that they're going to be able to maintain their housing. And another thing that happens that's really significant is that if somebody's out on the streets, we tend to use like an emergency service system. Tend to be more reliant on shelter beds, detox, hospitals, policing, shelters, drop-in, so on and so forth. But if the first step is housing, a lot of those services tend to decrease in terms of how they access it. So something we're seeing is that it can cost anywhere. For a person to live day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year on the streets, it can cost between $70,000 to $134,000 a year for an individual who's chronic or episodically homeless to remain on our streets here in Canada. And that's when you pull together the costs of these emergency services. But if we were first providing housing and then providing access to recovery-based approaches, that it can drop to anywhere between $21,000 to $34,000 a year. So there's it's a system that doesn't just recognize human rights. It's, you know, it's the right thing to do, but at the same time as being the right thing to do, it's something that actually saves money.
When someone does get into housing, what supports have to be there for them?
When somebody's coming out of long-term homelessness, it's like, I think of it here in our community, we have something that's called a supportive housing network, and we call it SUN. And it's trying to think about if somebody's coming out of a shelter system or rough sleeping or couch surfing after a long period of time, it's almost like you're sending somebody off to university, your kid, for the first time. And you got to think about all the things that they don't even know that they need. They need to build a home. So there's material pieces. So part of what's needed to help rehouse somebody is access to, you know, any of those creature comforts that make a house a home. So in terms of like bedding and a bed. We work with community for those donations, and just the basic things in terms of even figuring out how to restock your cabinet and, you know, spices and your refrigerator, and then smaller things in terms of looking at cleaning products and what you're comfortable with. Outside of that, though, like when somebody's moving into a place, what they need is community. When I come out of a shelter environment or a street environment, I have a community out there, and I have a system and I have a routine that I lean into for somebody on the streets. But when you move into an apartment, you lose that. So one of the most important things when we're actually transitioning it, the first step is housing, but it's not the last step by any means. It doesn't just fix it. The second piece is helping to bring community to that person that they choose, that they feel comfortable with. And that's really difficult. It's really difficult to pull off. And that's why it's such an important piece of Housing First, is to make sure our community has those types of supports there. And what that looks like is if you're going to build a relationship with anybody, it has to have a level of authenticity, and it takes time. So real Housing First supports means that you have initially somebody be checking in and stopping in and not parenting you, not governing you, but being with you. And that's a really important distinction. So a Housing First program is really good at building solidarity with somebody and encouraging them and building trust, which is a real skill set to do that authentically with somebody. So it comes by building a little bit of trust prior to housing, being willing to step back if you're the wrong person for the job and finding somebody who might be better suited. If a clinician's not working, it means we're leaning more into peer supports or what models will. Because for someone to be able to build not just the material supports they need a community support as well. It takes just as much forethought and planning, if not more, than the material piece.
What is the 20,000 Homes campaign?
20,000 Homes campaign is really neat. It's based off of something that came out of the States called 100,000 Homes. And it was, the idea is that us as Canadians, we collectively and communities across Canada decide that we are going to work our tail off to be able to house 20,000 of the most vulnerable people in our community across Canada by 2018, 2019. And it was picked up because in the United States, there was a really neat movement where they did a similar thing for 100,000 homes, and they saw that giving themselves a specific number, getting communities to work together on very specific measurables, helping communities develop strategies, like real strategies that are evidence-based to work in terms of getting people off the streets and helping them maintain housing. And so in the States, looking at kind of like their population in conjunction to ours, federally they decided through the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness has been really the folks who've taken a leadership role with this campaign. And they've been working in partnership in the States with something called Community Solutions, who are amazing, who've developed a lot of good metrics, a lot of good strategies in terms of helping to make a change at a community level as opposed to just using an emergency response to homelessness. Community Solutions has worked hard to be able to adopt more of a systems approach, which means that I'm not just looking at how am I going to help somebody in this immediate emergency, which is important. We have to have those. It's also looking at how can I work upstream? How do I end the homelessness? Like so much of what we've done in society has been to help us when we're in a state of crisis. But the next day I'm still in crisis. I'm still in the streets. I'm still hungry and I'm still homeless. What's beautiful about the Community Solutions and the 100,000 Homes campaign and here in Canada is the 20,000 Homes campaign. It shifts the conversation. This is that's not good enough. We're looking for real long-term solutions. And it gives communities a way to be able to track their data and give a real focus monthly in terms of making sure that we're actually, it sounds cheesy, but you're moving the needle on knowing who is your homeless population. It encourages each city to have what's called a by names list that we know the people by name, you know, who are on our streets and that we've assessed every person on our streets in terms of being able to understand their acuity level. So that's their level of vulnerability, how long they've been homeless, what kinds of challenges they live with. And this is all by a person's consent. None of this is done without somebody's participation. And then based on that information is triaging people. And a logical housing or homelessness system is one that does triage people. Because sometimes you look at, like in our city here in the community we live with, in Fredericton, it's estimated that 730 people experienced homelessness last year. Of that 730, though, there may only be 15% of that population who've been trapped in the cycle of chronic and episodic homelessness. And like we were talking about before, knowing who is chronic and who is episodic is so critical. Because even though it's only 15% of the homeless population, that group relies on over half of all the services in our homeless system. And so by using something like 20,000 homes, we're figuring out who's chronic, how do we best support that individual, and how do we attract change over time? So we can demonstrate, like, I think to our federal, provincial, municipal partners and other people working in the sector that real change is possible.
So was the homeless count here linked to Fredericton's engagement in the 20,000 homes campaign?
A little bit, yeah. It came out as a result of two things. The first was under the homelessness partnering strategy. Is a requirement of HPS coming into 2018 that every community will do a point-in-time count. And a point-in-time count is something where it's just all de-identified data. It's all anonymous, and it just gives you a snapshot. In terms of it's something that's used in communities, it's like a little bit of a census, and governments will often use that to track needs or change over time. Here in Fredericton, we made the choice to go a step further and we combined our point in time count, which was mandated. It wasn't required in 2016, but we knew it was going to become required practice. So it was a chance for us to get in there and get involved and start building the training, the infrastructure needed for us to pull this off. But we went above and beyond that and connected our point in time count with the 20,000 homes, what's called the registry week. And that's where you build a by names list. And that's where instead of just collecting the de-identified data, you give people who are living on the streets a chance to say, this is who I am, this is what I'm living with, and this is what I feel I need. So with that data, it's a really good first step in terms of when you look at ending homelessness. because it gives something that our outreach teams or ICM teams or intensive case management can actually begin working with.
You said this is who I am, which brings me to the film Housing First, The Rest Will Follow. How did that film come about?
So Housing First, The Rest Will Follow is just a short promotional video that came about as an application our CAG submitted to something called Open Your Eyes Fredericton, which is a Doc Talks project, where they realize a lot of nonprofits don't have the capacity to do rigorous communication campaigns. And they gave a chance for nonprofits to apply and to pitch social issues at really broad reaching, and that they would help develop just a short promotional video. They would do other supports around communications, web-based formats, and social media. And we submitted the idea of helping us to promote awareness around Housing First, with the idea that we would be able to bring about some of the financial supports, but also, the political capital that's sort of needed to get this moving, right? And through this process, they developed a short film, and they weren't sure, like, these are folks who don't work in homelessness, people coming from Doc Talks. They have folks who are videographers or people who do sound engineering or do web-based stuff, but they don't work in homelessness. And they really needed themselves to understand the challenges that people had on the streets and some of the opportunities to change it. So how they went about learning that is they spent time meeting with somebody in our community who's used Housing First style approaches in ending her homelessness. And she really helped educate them about some of the barriers she had in the past, how she ended up on the streets. It isn't just as easy as getting a roof. You can end up homeless again pretty quickly. And so they spent time getting to know her, and they used her as a subject of their film to tell that story. And they thought that, okay, if we want people to understand homelessness in Fredericton, then why don't we just tell it through the story of a person as opposed to through data or something that's so cold? So the film is just a short story that follows someone in our community who's been a leader, I think, in a lot of ways in terms of advocating for peer support, and who's lived with a number of challenges in regards to housing herself. And the film is available online for people to check it out. And it's at www.roadhomefredericton.com. And it's something we're just encouraging people to check it out, share it. We want people to be able to go and check out our own website and learn ways that they can get involved, not just in homelessness, but in ending homelessness.
What do you think is one of the biggest myths about people who are homeless or poor?
Quite obviously is that we don't work hard enough, or they don't work hard enough, and that people have earned their poverty is a real common myth. And I wish it was that simple. You know, if that was the case, then it would be easy to put it in a box, right?
And it would just get everybody a job.
There you go, right? There's a good point, you know, is that if you could just get a job, then you won't be homeless. Like, there's another myth about it as well, Kay, that you bring up that it's so inherent in terms of how foolishly we've responded to it. Like, we put good energy after bad and good money after bad in terms of saying, well, first we're going to employ somebody and then they won't be homeless. But how do you employ somebody when they're living with trauma, when they're living with really complex needs, when they're living hand to mouth or in a state of crisis? Like, first, there's all kinds of other things we need to have some empathy about.
Right.
That you got to respond first, because none of those other things won't happen unless we do that first and just bite the bullet. And so I think that a lot of one of the worst stereotypes is that, you know, that people have chosen it, or they oversimplify it in terms of saying all they need is this employment. But there's a lot that comes before that. And in some situations, employment isn't going to be possible. And even outside of employment, people still have an awful lot of incredible value that they bring to society. And I think that we fail to recognize that sometimes. I could go on with that for quite a while, but this is one of the things I see. And the last one is that people choose to be homeless. I understand that. Like, when I think we're fortunate enough when people haven't experienced homelessness, so they're not living closely or working closely with people on the streets, it's a really common misconception is, oh, but there are people who want to be homeless, right? And I would hear that almost every day in terms of working with people who are non-homeless or people in systems. And I find that one very interesting. And I think it's a way of challenging that is, I've known a lot of people who have chosen to rough sleep outside as opposed to being in shelter environments, or I've known people who've lived in shelter environments instead of apartments. And they make a lot of tough choices about where am I going to have personal freedom. So it's almost like I'm sacrificing personal freedom over housing, because it's a choice that sometimes when people are living in deep poverty or people who have complex needs or who may have addiction issues, they aren't necessarily going to be able to have housing and personal freedom. They choose between either or. And I think I've seen people who've been moved into housing environments, people who've lived with long-term poverty, be subjected with rules that any of us who are paying market rent or paying a mortgage would never live with, because they'd be violations of our human rights. And for instance, we see people who are in low-income housing or subsidized housing, not to point fingers at anyone specifically, but sometimes we have really harsh conditions that set people up for eviction rather quickly that wouldn't happen in normal environments. Like, for instance, here in our own community, there's some buildings where people aren't allowed to go outside in their pajama pants to have a cigarette, or you're not allowed to carry a coffee cup in the hall. And those kinds of rules are really kind of like nanny state or parenting for somebody where it just doesn't make sense to do that. For people who are accustomed to being very resourceful or really independent and resourceful enough that they can actually live outside and live, to go into a housing environment where those are the types of rules, it really drives them back outside, or it makes that choice. So when people say, well, that person's choosing to be homeless, it's not really that they're choosing homelessness, it's just they're choosing freedom, or they're choosing their pride or their independence above maybe the humiliation of the other option. So a housing first model, it really does start that the tenant doesn't necessarily have to be perfect to be housed. It acknowledges those barriers that has prevented the person from working into mainstream housing or subsidized units. Precisely, we have to hold open space for that, for them even to become housed. And that actually by being housed, you can actually help mitigate that over time. But unless you hold open space for that initially, you don't break the cycle. So this whole notion that people choose homelessness, for me, is something that's absurd. If you look at the bigger picture of someone's life, it's the lesser of two evils for that person. And many of us, thankfully, can't relate to that experience.
What potential goals or possible challenges do you foresee for CAG?
The goal, the broad stroke, is, of course, to be able to see us end chronic homelessness by making sure we have intensive case management, flexible sort of community treatment, peer support, and then access to the rent subsidies and affordable housing that's needed in that system. So that's the goal, right? And the real challenges in that, it means that it's a real shift from the status quo. The metaphor that I use in my mind is that for a number of years, it's as though it's like we are all standing down by a river and we see somebody drowning, and we run down and we pull that person out. And as soon as we pull that person out, we see somebody else, and we have to get more people down there to help us save that next person. Oh my heavens, there's another person coming down the river. And so we're getting everybody down by the river, pulling them out, and we get really good at it. We're learning to be able to get them blankets and keep them warm. We're not stepping on each other's toes. A traditional homeless system that's based on emergency services is that point in the river. And the logical question is, well, why is there people in the river? And we say, well, let's send somebody upstream to figure it out. But if there's people actually drowning right now in the river and we let someone go, that person might get past us. So one of the real struggles is that we have real needs right now at an emergency level in our community. And if we actually decrease the intensity of supports we have at that river, and those services, what those look like, those are shelter beds. Those are soup kitchens, outreach services, those are drop-ins, and even at a certain level, it's community policing and hospitals and different ways that we've responded to homelessness there. If you pull somebody away from that system, it means people are going to slip by and more people will die. But if we want to prevent people from falling in the river in the first place, it means we actually need to have more people upstream. So the real challenge is twofold for us in Fredericton, is that for us to end chronic and episodic homelessness, it's not that we need to do a better job managing the people at the mouth of the river. It's that we actually have to grow the amount of resources we have for 3 years, 3 to 4 years, so we can do both. So that's one challenge, is building the optimism in our community that it's something that is solvable, that solutions exist. They're more cost-effective than what we've been doing, and they're more ethical. So the real challenge is around building that optimism and getting the fire in our bellies to do it, because it's not just about putting our backs into something forever and ever. If we're able to actually get upstream and prevent that 15% of chronic and episodic homelessness to exist in our community and eliminate it, and we have evidence-based approaches to do so, if we do that, it means that there's actually 50% fewer people in the river, only half as many people in the river, because that small group of our homeless population is responsible for over half of all the services in our homeless system, right? So the real challenge is if people can really grasp that, it means that we only need half as many people by the river to do the work we've done over the past 30 years. And just imagine what all those resources could do. They're really positive and really beautiful. So I think the challenge is the optimism, the education. And then finally, it's about bringing together nonprofits who we all have our own view about how we solve poverty and homelessness. And it's difficult to take a lot of the information that Housing First is based on, we would perceive at a community level to be coming from like think tanks or ivory towers of people who aren't in the trenches doing it. And so sometimes there's a bias about systems, new systems or new approaches, and we don't necessarily believe it's going to work here. Or yeah, but. So there's a lot of those things around solutions. And so the challenge is, I think, from a CAG perspective, is really making sure that people locally have access to information so they understand that Housing First, A, it's not easy to implement. And unless it's Housing First, it's not Housing First, and it's not going to have the right kind of outcomes, right? But really trying to build unity amongst the different nonprofits that are serving those vulnerable populations, that it's possible and it's worth the change and it's worth growing our response collectively for 3 or 4 years.
Well, on that note, which actually is, I think, a very positive one, I think we'll end with asking if you have just one parting thought that you would like to share.
Is that people should get excited about ending homelessness. I think in society, there are so many complex issues that it's difficult to wrap our mind around, and it can feel really disempowering. Homelessness is something that we collectively as society have a lot of control over. Therefore, I think we should get fired up about it and excited about it and feel empowered to be part of the solution. So I would leave it with people to, instead of feeling disempowered or disenfranchised or overwhelmed when we think about homelessness, instead to know that there's very simple things all of us can do, as simple as supporting United Way and saying you want them to be able to put funds towards Housing First. That's an option in our community. It can be as simple as helping with welcome baskets for the people who are moving into apartments every month. There are real ways for us to get involved in this work that ends somebody's homelessness, and it's something that we can be proud of 3 or 4 years from now to say we've collectively pulled it off.
We've been speaking with Faith McFarland, the Executive Director of the Fredericton Community Action Group on Homelessness. To learn more about this organization, visit their Facebook page, where you'll also find a link to their website, Road Home Fredericton. Until next time, I'm Kay Brookland, and this is 1 in 7 on CHSR FM.